Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Northern Hills Regional Railroad Authority, et al. Appellants, James A. Swabe, et al. Appellees. For the appellants, we have Mr. Thomas Brady, an attorney from Spearfish, and for the appellees, we have Mr. Roger Tellinghues and Mr. Eric Strawn. I understand, Mr. Tellinghues, you'll be making the argument this morning?
Yes, sir.
All right. Very well. Mr. Brady, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Please, the court. Thank you, counsel, and might I extend special thanks to Justice Sabers and the years dedicated to this court and the state judiciary. It's greatly appreciated by the entire bar. I represent the South Dakota Department of Transportation. I represent the South Dakota Game, Fish, and Parks. And I represent the Northern Hills Regional Railroad Authority, which is a governmental entity without taxation powers that is made up by the communities of Lead, Deadwood, Whitewood, Sturgis, Belfouche, and Spearfish. The Northern Hills Regional Railroad Authority is a rail entity established for the sole purpose of protecting, preserving, maintaining 9.1 miles of railroad right-of-way, a rail corridor located between the cities of Whitewood and Deadwood. That was established in 1890 by the Fremont, Elkhorn, and Missouri Valley Railway Company. And the right-of-way was a combination of two types of properties. One was what is referred to as 1875 Act right-of-way, wherein by congressional act the right-of-way was conveyed to the railroad. The other aspect of it is where patents had been issued prior to the establishment of this rail line, and it was from those patentees that the Fremont, Elkhorn, and Missouri Valley acquired deeds from those parties to comprise the 9.1 miles of rail line. The United States Congress recognized approximately 150 years ago the importance of creating as well as preserving these transportation corridors as the country and the West was developed. And it is one of those transportation corridors that the Northern Hills Regional Railroad Authority is attempting to preserve. The authority has fee title to that property that's not 1875 Act right-of-way. And that fee title is acquired, one, from the conveyance of the original patentees to the Fremont Elkhorn, then to the Chicago Northwestern, then by the merger with the Union Pacific, and thus the authority acquired a deed from the Union Pacific, acquired a deed from the DM&E, which is now merging into or being acquired by the Canadian National, and there was a residual question as to what the DM&E had in the UP, and acquired a deed from the state of South Dakota Department of Transportation. So title is vested in the Northern Hills Regional Railroad Authority. In due respect to all those parties who have their land subject to 1875 Act right-of-way, or in respect to those parties upon either that adjoin or own property on each side of the fee property, it has to be recognized that those patentees, at the time the deeds were acquired by the Fremont, or the subsequent patentees of the property upon which the 1875 Act right-of-way was granted, have not, did not, do not own the property. They gave nothing for it. They have not been, it hasn't been transferred to them. They don't own it. It is those parties that started litigation. The Northern Hills Regional Railroad Authority has started no litigation. We're merely parties. So with that backdrop, we've got several errors noted in our appellant's brief. I'm going to focus on the two critical, the larger picture issues, but by so doing, I'm not, nor do we abandon issues 5 and 6, and things of that nature. I'm going to separate the discussion into two categories. One is the fee lands. There's three types of property in this. Fee lands, excluded property in the 1875 Act right-of-way. The fee lands, and pursuant to stipulation of facts, number 4, that land was owned in fee by the Fremont, Elkhorn, and Missouri, and as I earlier described, the authority now has fee title to those lands.
Let me ask you a question about that.
Yes.
The stipulation, paragraph 4, makes a distinction. It's divided into two sub-paragraphs. In one of them, it says the parties stipulate their fee title. And in the second subdivision, it says that the parties claim that there's fee title. Is that distinction of any significance as far as the fee title status of this property?
You need to look at the legal descriptions of the properties
in those
sections. And
it just seems to me that it perhaps someone was making or leaving room for a claim that those aren't necessarily fee lands in that second part of paragraph 4.
4A, that is what you're referring to, I believe, and there's two sub-paragraphs relative to the Greylep and the Lewis deeds, and I think that is not an intended distinction of difference. The predominant land descriptions as through 4, parent A parent through parent F parent is conceded to be B title property. Now, the subcategories of the Greylep and Lewis deals have a different discussion area that is somewhat limited to the facts of those deeds and limited to that, but no, there is no reservation on the fee issue. It was a stipulated fact approved by the court, and that is the subject matter of our appeal.
Why do you think the court disregarded that?
Disregarded what court?
The fact that you stipulated that there were, this was fee, and the court seems to treat it like it's just a right-of-way. It doesn't even refer to the fact that there's a stipulation.
Well, I respect that, and why the court did it, I guess, is why we are here, because it's undisputed that it's fee, and it was agreed that it was fee, and that's the issue.
What are we bound by that stipulation? It is a question of law, isn't it?
Well, yes, and I think both in the citations, and I direct you to the reply brief as to why we are bound by that, and all of us in the regard to with that stipulation of fact, this court's review is strictly limited to the proper law. And what is the law in regard to fee title lands? And that is the focus and the limitation.
So we have to, by the stipulation as to fee title question, we're bound by that, and the only thing we can do is to decide the question of reverter or subsequent condition. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. The party stipulated to that. It's sound, and that is the agreed facts upon which we are to make a determination. I would agree with that, Chair.
Well, the appellee is arguing that it's an easement, and somehow the circuit court determined it could be abandoned, which, and the only logical, or I shouldn't say the only logical, but the most apparent explanation would be that the circuit court must have treated it as easement property.
Well, I mean, that might be some speculation, you can, but what's troubling to us is that this governmental entity has fee title to this right-of-way. And through a process that I would submit was a strained effort to somehow divest us of our ownership of this property or to avoid addressing the issues head-on as we focused or directed to the circuit court is a process that is troubling to me in that it is very simplistic to have concluded in favor of the Northern Hills Regional Railroad Authority that we own the property, that we own it in fee, that it's a condition subsequent on the reverter language, that the statute of limitations has passed to even challenge it, and that there has not been abandonment, either by the ICC abandonment of service and by the deed from the Chicago Northwestern to the state of South Dakota, or by the resolution of the Department of Transportation, wherein they said they no longer intended to use that right-of-way for a highway purpose. That is not a conveyance of fee title, but merely a declaration of them that they aren't going to use it, versus the only way the state could divest itself of ownership is by deed under the citations and the rules that I cite in the case. It's a very simple process to conclude why we own this fee right-of-way. And to go through the exercise to find some process how there might be a different argument upon which some convoluted argument can be made that we don't have it to take it away from us and grant it to someone who never acquired it or had any interest in it is troubling to me.
Well, did the circuit court treat it as an easement or as fee?
It treated a small tract of it as fee, and that was the Kroll and Clark deeds. And but the error of that, even though it shouldn't have treated that as easement, those properties weren't in the fee group. But there was no reversionary language in that, and for reasons as otherwise cited, that right-of-way was retained by the DOT in their resolution 14217 that was later conveyed to the Northern Hills Regional Railroad Authority. It is only there where the court talked about it being easement, not on the fee property.
Well, I'm still having trouble understanding how the circuit court got to its conclusion, because it's a very brief discussion of this issue, and it just says the property is subject to abandonment.
That's correct. It literally jumped over the agreed facts that it was fee property and merely focused on the ICC application in 1970 to seek abandonment of service, and then somehow concluded that abandonment of service and picking up the tracks was abandonment of the road, triggering the reverter language.
Well, if you've abandoned, you have no service, you have no tracks, what else are you going to do with the land?
Sell it, and you look at the 1968 resolution of the Chicago Northwestern, that is precisely what their plan was to do. They were going to abandon service, because you have to do that, just like this court previously saw in Barney, and so that they are no longer obligated to carry freight and run that line. Once the ICC, which has limited jurisdiction on service, allows that, then a process of things can happen. First of all, they don't have to run trains. Secondly, they could, if Section 9, 12, and 13 applied to the 1875 Act right-of-way, those statutes allowed the railroads to transfer to states or other railroads or, thing, or to the states and things of that nature. On the fee property, and you look at the contract, to abandon, be mindful, to abandon, you have to have a concurrent thought process of intent to abandon and then take an act to abandon. What they did was obtained abandonment of service, and they had a contract with the state of South Dakota selling to the state this right-of-way and a lot of other right-of-way for a total of $170,000, $5,000 of which was assigned to the fee portion of this right-of-way. And they sold to the state pursuant to that contract in 1970. Actually, they obtained an extension of that to 1972. I think it's Exhibit 39 because they didn't have their iron off yet. So their intent was to sell. They did sell. They did convey to the state. So somehow the court didn't address those issues either as to why there could be an abandonment of the road when, in fact, underlying the process and before the beginning of the process to seek abandonment of service, that the Chicago Northwestern had this plan to sell. It never intended to relinquish the road. Now,
of course, that's, if it's an easement, I mean, that's, we got to go back to that. If it's an easement, there's a different analysis because than there would be if it's fee land. And I guess I'm struggling with this because in your briefs, you seem to be talking past each other. You're talking about, quite fairly and understandably, the fact that you stipulated this was fee land, and then the appellees come up with an argument that this is an easement, which really is a kind of a new argument that doesn't appear to have been made by the trial court. I mean, made to the trial court. You know, what happens if we look at these deeds ourselves and we say, well, you know, maybe these are easements. You know, maybe these aren't. Maybe this was intended as an easement. How do we handle that?
Well, first of all, I would respectfully submit that's not your task, and that we have a stipulated fact approved by the court upon which the judgment was entered. Secondly, the appellees did not assign notice of review or in any manner allow this to be addressed at the lower court. So, again, on your review, it's fee and what happens. In due respect, I think that's where we're at. Otherwise, we're just tossed into the abyss, and we should not be. That is how it's presented, that's how it is, and I think that's the proper conclusion.
Now, earlier you said the stipulation dealt with a question of law in regards to the deeds. Just a few seconds ago you said it was a question of fact. Which is it?
It's a stipulation of facts upon which the court is merely to apply the law. The parties are bound by the facts as presented, and there was no dispute as to those facts.
And you can appreciate there's a huge difference because we can review the law de novo. If it's a stipulation as to law, we're not bound by that, but a stipulation of fact is a different animal.
Agreed. You are correct. The stipulated facts are what we're bound by. You review the law, you know, I agree. I have limited time. I need to address the 1875 Act right-of-way issue and do so in light of Brown and direct you to my appellate's brief and reply brief. But quite simply, as the Brown decision made a very narrow decision in that it said Section 912 does not apply to property upon which a patent was issued prior to the enactment of 912. Given that, as the Bia case of the Ninth Circuit stated, and as others stated, that is 912, 913 is the only process by which there was a possibility that the patentees could acquire title to this. It created the possibility. Now, since 912 does not apply, it is congressional. It's a congressional grant, and in due respect to this and other courts, you do not have subject matter jurisdiction to take that grant away. It takes Congress to take it away. We are the successor railroad to that, and that is done.
Didn't we say in Brown that the patents took it away?
Pardon?
I thought we said in Brown that the patents essentially took it away.
No, not at all.
Through legal effect, that's what occurred.
No, what you said in Brown is that the United States does not have a reversionary interest if it's abandoned, okay? But only Congress can determine how it's abandoned. If granted it, it can only take it away. And if 912 doesn't apply, which was the section that defined how something could be abandoned and how the possibility of it going to the patentees, that was their hope. Now it takes a congressional act.
But didn't the U.S. Supreme Court say, though, that abandonment is determined by the common law of the states?
I don't see that in railroad right-of-way, because it's a specific grant. It was this in particular was created by the 1875 Act, and I disagree with that wholeheartedly.
Is there any U.S. Supreme Court case that has said that, your argument on abandonment, that it's a congressional determination as opposed to reverting back to the state common law?
Well, where I... if you would look at the appellant's brief and reply brief, it's the federal rule of law. It's you look at U.S. v. Washington Improvement. It's 189F674 at 682, a 1911 case. And then in there is cases cited by the U.S. Supreme Court. The Washington case, U.S. v. Washington, deals specifically with railroad right-of-way. In 1911, and there's other U.S. Supreme Court cases that deal with other congressional grants of land, and so I do think, Your Honor, it's in there, and Congress gave it, and only Congress can take it away.
Your time has expired, Mr. Brady. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Tellinghuis, and you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the Court, Counsel, Justice Sabers, I too would like to echo Mr. Brady's thank you and congratulations to you for a distinguished career on this bench, and we wish you well in your retirement. I'd like to start out, if I may, with my response, just trying to address a couple of the issues that's been brought to light by the Court's questioning. But before doing that, I want to just touch very quickly on the 1875 right-of-way tracts, which are part of this case. It's the appellee's position, of course, that those tracts of land, those tracts where the railroad established its right-of-way pursuant to the 1875 Act prior to the patents being issued, has really been determined by this Court in its recent decision in Brown. And to say that the Court in Brown did not make a decision or did not address the import of the lack of applicability, if you will, of Section 912, I think is incorrect. If you look at the two cases that Brown really looked to in coming to its decision to overrule this Court's earlier decision in Barney, that being Hash and Bears, the Federal Court of Appeals case being Hash and the Bears case being the Federal Court of Claims case, both of those cases concluded that based upon prior Supreme Court precedent, the right-of-way that was established pursuant to the 1875 Act granted the railroads nothing more than an easement, and that upon abandonment, the land didn't revert to the adjoining property owner, but they already owned the land by virtue of their patent. The land was simply unburdened by the easement, and the railroad took no further interest in the property and had nothing to convey. And in fact, in Bears and in Hash, both were takings claims, and both concluded that even though the federal government, through subsequent legislation, that being the Rails to Trails Act, could impose upon private property these trail systems for recreational use, that amounted to a taking, for which the property owners were entitled to compensation. I think that in a nutshell is a very clear statement as to the state of the law from the federal level as it has been adopted by this Court in Brown as to what is the significance of an easement granted to a railroad under the 1875 Act when it's later abandoned by the railroad.
What is your response, then, to your opposing counsel's view of the stipulation that you have entered into, that this is these conveyances are fee?
With respect to the fee conveyances, specifically the stipulation of fact, I will concur with Mr. Brady that we stipulated that there were parcels of property that were actually in private ownership prior to the arrival of the railroad to this area. And in those cases, the landowners gave deeds to the railroads, allowing them to build their railroad across or adjoining their property. It may have been somewhat improvident on my part to stipulate at the time that the stipulation was entered into that those amounted to fee simple interest. But I'll live with that. I'll live with that.
How can you claim their easements then?
Your Honor, I'm not going to claim today that they're easements. What I'm going to suggest to you is that in each and every one of those deeds that granted the right to the railroad to build their railroad across this private property, they contained a reversionary interest that was very specific, that concluded or provided that...
You're changing your argument then from what was in your brief, because your brief says easement, so today you're changing it.
I understand that. Yes, sir, and I apologize for that error. I mean, that
I
was...
You apologize, and I just want to get it straight where we're at.
I want to be very clear that the statement in the brief that the court found that these deeds that were granted prior to the arrival of the railroad amounted to an establishment that they were easements is incorrect. That's not what the court found. In fact, if the court looks at the memorandum decision of Judge Macy, it's very clear that the court determined it referenced the deeds as being fee simple, then quoted the specific reversionary language and went on to conclude that if the parties could approve abandonment, the reversionary interest would kick in and would become applicable. With respect to those reversionary interests, the appellant has tried to suggest in their brief that these were conditions subsequent. And I must confess to the court that prior to this appeal, I didn't know sigum from Khmer about what the difference between a condition subsequent or a fee simple with an interest determinable. I would be less than candid if I suggested to you today that I have a very clear understanding of the distinction, because I will confess, in reading some of the cases that are available that talk about these very old property interests, the further back in the law you go, the more confusing it gets, because they use terminology that we're very unaccustomed to in this day and age. But I believe the important distinction between the two is that with a fee simple determinable, which was what we believe these deeds provided for, upon the happening of the condition which terminates the interest for the estate, in this case the railroad's estate in this property, nothing more has to be done by the property owner to recover their property.
Well, that seems to be the easy part of the equation. The tough part is to figure out whether their fee is simple determinable or a condition subsequent.
I understand, Justice Inter, and I think that if the court looks closely at the restatement on property that was cited in the appellant's brief, I believe that there's an easier way to approach this, and I'm just going to quote from the appellant's brief. It's actually page 10. It's comment J to section 45, the creation of an estate in fee simple subject to a condition subsequent is described in the following language. Except when the attempted condition is illegal, an estate in fee simple subject to a condition subsequent is created by an otherwise effective conveyance which contains, one, some one of the following phrases, namely, quote, upon express condition that, unquote, or, quote, upon condition that, quote, or, quote, provided that, quote, or a phrase of like import. I'll stop right there, because I will admit that each one of the deeds that are purported to convey these fee simple interests have in their reversionary language, they begin with the words provided that. But then the restatement goes on and says, and also, two, a provision that if the stated event occurs, the conveyor, quote, may enter and terminate the estate hereby conveyed, unquote, or a phrase of like import. In other words, I think the distinction between a condition subsequent requiring a property owner to actually take an affirmative action to come in and retake their property, that is the distinction, is that it requires the right of reentry or the power to reenter the property. But in the case of a fee simple determinable, it simply provides that upon the happening of the condition, the prior owner's estate in that property ends. There's nothing more that's required of the reversionary interest to come in and take over the property or resume their ownership. And I think it's very important for this court to look at the specific language of the deeds. I will grant you that reading these old deeds is a bit of a challenge. And if you have the advantage of getting the big blown-up copies like we did originally, it's a little easier to follow. But when you read the deeds, it's very, very clear that neither the then grantors nor the representatives of the Fremont Elkhorn Missouri Valley Railroad in 1890, when these deeds were being drafted and executed, ever intended that the grantors or their successors or assigns would have to come in and actually bring some type of an ejectment action to recover their property from the railroad if the railroad abandoned or ceased to use the property for railroad purposes. I want to also just draw the court's attention again to these deeds because we make some...
Are those the deeds that are all... Are all the deeds that you're referring to in your appendix?
They're not in the appendix, Your Honor, but I believe they're in the record that was provided to the court. I can give you the specific...
Well, a number of the deeds are attached, isn't it?
There are some attached.
There are some. And the reason I bring this up is that it would be very easy to read a couple of the deeds and assume that the language is all very consistent throughout all of the deeds. But I would direct the court's attention specifically to Exhibits D-1 through D-6. These six deeds represent the handwritten deeds that conveyed railroad right-of-ways to the railroad following the issuance of the patents in 1890. And the reason I would encourage you to read each and every one of them is because there are some very minor distinctions between them in terms of the purposes for which these rights-of-way were given to the railroad. But they all contain the same reversionary language that provide that if the railroad's not built within 2 years, in some cases 10 years in others, or if the railroad right-of-way is ever relocated, or if it's ever abandoned, that the property interest that is being conveyed pursuant to the deed reverts to the then grantor, their successors, or assigns. And so, again, coming back to the initial question, Justice Konenkamp, about are we maintaining that these were easements or are we sticking with our stipulated facts? I submit to you that under either analysis, the end result is the same. The now property owners who trace their ownership back to the original grantors under these deeds are the owners of this property.
But in order to get there under your stipulated facts, we'd have to determine that they're fee simple determinable.
That's correct. That is correct.
Otherwise, if it's not, and it's a condition subsequent, then you would have had to come back in and do something earlier.
That's correct. I would concede that. With respect to this issue of the abandonment, the court said that with respect to the properties that were the post-patent conveyances, that's how we referred to them in the lower court, those being the parcels that were conveyed by deed to the railroad, I don't think there can be any question that the C&W Railroad in 1970 not only intended to abandon its right-of-way, but physically went out and did so. contrary to the assertion by appellants in their brief that all the ICC did was permit the CNW to abandon its service, if you look at the application and the subsequent ICC certificates and orders and the notices that were published, the documentation from the CNW in 1970 is replete with references to abandonment of the railroad line. Now, the question is asked, well, isn't the conveyance by the railroad then somewhat counterintuitive to a determination that they're abandoning this right-of-way? Well, I remind the court of the response that was offered by Ken Duell when that question was asked, and that is, this is the classic case of selling the Brooklyn Bridge. And really, the state of South Dakota, for $5,000, purchased whatever interest the CNW had left in this right-of-way. Now, there are some pieces that the state ended up with, and we've stipulated to those in the lower court, and they are not before this court on appeal. There were some small parcels to which there were no reversionary interests retained, and to which the rate 1875 Railroad Right-of-Way Act did not apply. And those parcels are, in fact, now lodged in the ownership of the Northern Hills Regional Railroad. But I would suggest to you that the abandonment issue is really a red herring, in my opinion, because the ICC clearly granted the CNW permission to completely dismantle its line, which it did. In fact, in the deed from the CNW to the state of South Dakota, they reserved the right for 30 days to go in and remove the remainder of their trackage and buildings and other equipment. And anything left behind was to be deemed abandoned.
Now, does this have, which parcels then would it, in the argument of the appellant, that the Congress would have to abandon? Are these the same parcels that you're talking about?
I'm not quite sure, Justice Meyer. I am certain that appellant is arguing that only Congress could abandon the 1875 right-of-way. I don't believe that there's any real argument, although I could be mistaken, about the post-patent conveyances, the ones that were...
And that's conveyed. The D1 through D6.
That's correct, yes. With respect to the 1875 right-of-way, though, this court has already addressed and has concluded, based on Hash and Bears, that the United States didn't retain anything, and thus the subsequent enactment of Section 912 didn't have any import or any application to these particular rights-of-way with respect to the abandonment by the CNW. Now, keep in mind, There hasn't been since 1970, and there still is not, any kind of public use of this right-of-way, this 9.1 miles. It has not been used by the CNW Railroad. It was never used by the Department of Transportation. And in fact, in the Department of Transportation's deed to Game Fish and Parks, they expressly accepted out from that conveyance these parcels, which the Department of Transportation in 1985 had resolved to abandon because they were no longer needed for highway purposes. And the Department of Transportation went through this entire 9.1 miles and identified which of the specific parcels within that 9.1 miles contained reversionary interests. And it was those particular parcels that the Department of Transportation, in its resolution 14218, that it identified parcels 1 through 7, 10, and on the first valuation map, and then parcels 1 through 4 on the second valuation map, as being no longer needed for highway purposes, and therefore they were abandoning it, and the property would revert to the prior grantors. And so I don't think that it's very... takes a great leap in logic to believe or to come to the conclusion that this right-of-way, for all intents and purposes, has been abandoned. It was the intention of the C&W to abandon it. It was the intention of the Department of Transportation to abandon it. And they both took steps or entered into, took action, if you will, to actually accomplish that abandonment. So the court's decision or the court's determination that it was abandoned in the appellee's opinion, of course, was not clearly in error and is clearly supported not only by the facts but by the law in this case. I only have a couple of minutes left, and I just very quickly want to touch on one other issue that I believe that Mr. Brady brought up, and that revolves around the excluded property. And I know he didn't get a chance to talk about it much. I assume he may talk about it in rebuttal. But quickly, the excluded property refers to conveyances to present-day owners wherein their grantors conveyed the XYZ parcel line north of the right-of-way. Because there was some confusion back a few years ago as to whether or not the right-of-way was owned by the property owners or not. No quiet title actions had been brought. It's our position that with respect to those property owners who received a warranty deed from their grantors, who excluded the right-of-way from their next conveyance, that under the after-acquired property provisions of the South Dakota statutes, the right-of-way continued on up the chain of title. And in those cases where property owners did not convey, if you will, any of the right-of-way, we still have pending adverse possession claims in the lower court. Those issues have not been resolved and are yet to be resolved. This quiet title action was focused entirely at the railroad, the Northern Hills Regional Railroad claims of ownership of the property, because until we could get those issues resolved, we really weren't in a position to move forward with the adverse possession claims that exist between private property owners. So with that, I would encourage this court.
Is that all within the 9.1 miles? All of these different?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
If I could ask one last question. You know, on the excluded property, as I read the trial court judgment, the trial court not only ruled against the authority on that, but affirmatively quieted title in your clients. And it doesn't seem to me that that portion of the judgment is appropriate.
Justice Sinner, I think that what the trial court did was the quieted title in my clients as against the Regional Railroad Authority. But if you read the very end of the decision, the court notes that there may still be unresolved claims.
I saw that in the memorandum, but the judgment appears to be a quiet title in favor of your clients.
And again, I think I would just come back
to... It's qualified.
It's just qualified. It's just as to my client's relation to the Northern Hills Regional Railroad.
Thank you, Mr. Tillinghuse.
Thank you.
Mr. Brady, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. Just to be no misunderstanding, there is a division of authority as to whether once 1875 Act right-of-way has been abandoned, as to whether the United States government has a reversionary interest or not. As this court noted in the Hash and Barris cases, in the Federal Circuit and in the Court of Claims, those cases determine that there is not a reversionary interest. But in the 9th and 10th Circuit, in the via the East Bay Regional Park District, 906 F. 2nd, 1330, and in the 10th Circuit, in Marshall v. C&W Transportation Company, 31 F. 3rd, 1078, 1990 and 1994 cases respectively, those circuits conclude that the United States government has a reversionary interest. The relevance is not particularly important on the issues before this court. That relevance is strictly in regard to whether under 16 U.S.C. 1241 to 1251 that where an abandoned right-of-way goes into reserve or trails, as to whether the U.S. government has done a taking or not because of the enactment. It doesn't trigger abandonment, it doesn't anything else. That's a separate issue as to whether the federal government has done another taking. But there is those division between those circuits, and someday that'll be resolved, I presume, by the United States Supreme Court.
But we're not in that camp.
Pardon?
But I don't believe we're in that camp.
Well, I don't, I'm not sure which camp you're in. What you used was the Barras-Hatch decision to say that 912 didn't apply. And I, you know, when you look at 939, that was enacted in 1875, it said Congress can enact things, which I would submit was 912 and 913. Maybe we have disagreement relative to the Brown conclusion. That said, if Brown says 912 and 913 doesn't apply, be mindful. We've got two tracts of ground out there. We've got 1875 right-of-way. If 912 and 913 doesn't apply, the CNW deed to the state is void, and the state never had it, and no resolution of the State Department of Transportation is even relevant. The Chicago Northwestern had it. The UP got it. Northern Hills Regional Railroad Authority owns it because we have a deed, and it can't be taken away other than by an act of Congress. Okay? On the other hand, what appellees try to argue is both sides of the fence. They say that under the application to the ICC, a limited government deal, Barney discussed it, no courts ever disagreed with it. They strictly deal with service. Their successor, the Service Transportation Board, deals with service and has granted the Black Hills Transportation, Inc. a modified certificate of authority to run on there, a whole issue we haven't talked about today, but it's in the briefs. They deal with service. Now, as BS explicitly stated, and the language is just so impeccably clear, that whether 912 or 13 applied, when the Chicago Northwestern was in the process of abandoning service, that isn't abandonment of the road. Look closely at the reversionary language. It's not abandonment of service. It doesn't say stop running a railroad. It says abandonment of the road. It's the right-of-way. Taking up tracks is not an abandonment of the road. Arguably, it's an incident of conduct, one would suggest, is in the process of doing that. But a conveyance by the Chicago Northwestern to the state of South Dakota is the antithesis of abandonment. You have to have concurrent thought process. And nowhere ever did they intend to abandon the road. They conveyed, the state got the fee, and the state got the 1875 right-of-way, which it in turn then has conveyed to, in part, to the Game Fish and Parks, in part retained. Okay, so be careful. Don't let them mix the apples with the oranges here. Now, the fee determinable versus condition subsequent. First of all, the state of South Dakota has enacted specific statutory provisions as to what a condition subsequent is and precisely what must occur and why there's a right of reentry. As counsel has acknowledged, if it's a condition subsequent, I think the next acknowledgement is the statute of limitations has run and they cannot challenge it. What they're arguing is a fee simple determinable. I would submit that's a strained argument to get there. But even if one were to get there, there's still no abandonment. The state owned it in fee if they rightfully retained the deed from the Chicago Northwestern, and there has to be the concurrent thought process of surrendering and giving a deed is absolutely inconsistent with an intent to say, I have nothing to do with that property. I pick up my iron and I have nothing to do. I'm walking off. I don't want it. I disclaim it. No, they deeded it. And it's no Brooklyn Bridge state got.
But isn't it inconsistent? I mean, if they say, well, in the deed we're acquiring this for railroad purposes, and all of a sudden they're setting a carnival up there or doing whatever they want to. I mean, is that language meaningless?
It doesn't say railroad purposes if they abandon the road. Now, this court in Barney, other courts have discussed the transition of the use of the transportation corridors that may be something other than a railroad. It's an abandonment of the road. The fact they picked up the iron, there could be a million reasons. It might have been 80-pound iron instead of 120-pound iron. It depends on what you want. It might be it had scrap value, but it didn't have active rail service value. But that isn't an abandonment of the road. That is picking up the iron. I concede it's an argument. Was it intended to take it a step to abandonment? But you never get past the deed. That is the unequivocal act inconsistent with a concurrent intent to abandon.
You know, people give quitclaim deeds every day to property that they may or may not have something in. But some title company wants a deed to clear it up, so they sign a quitclaim deed. And they may not have anything, any interest left in it.
That might be true. But what that says is they aren't warranting title. But you show me a governmental entity or a railroad that goes around giving warranty deeds, and I've seen something new. The fact is they conveyed the title they possessed. They had fee simple title, as the facts are stipulated and are now not disputed. That's what they conveyed. So to say they didn't have something, they did. And they conveyed it. And that's the chain of title in this. And it tracks. And look at the 1968 resolution. They wish to pick words out of it to suggest an intent to abandon the road. It's nonsense. It explicitly says they're going to sell it. They're going to take their iron and sell the land. And that's what they did. That controls the fee stuff. That controls all the fee property in this lawsuit. The 1875 Act right-of-way, that's an easement. And that was transferred to the state under 913, or it wasn't, it's still in the back of the railroad, and we have it. So be careful. Don't allow 1875 Act right-of-way land confuse the issue with fee land. They had fee to it. Indisputed.
And the fee, and you agree that those are in that exhibit D1 through whatever, the fee land, those are the deeds you're talking about as well?
That's correct.
D1 through D6.
In stipulation fact 4, and that sets forth the legals, and I believe those are the underlying historical documents. But, so, I go back. We're attempting to preserve this 9.1 mile of corridor, created, contemplated by the United States Congress for transportation purposes. And we own the fee title to the fee land, and we possess the easement rights under the 1875 Act.
Your time has expired, Mr. Brady. Thank you.
And thank you.
Court being recessed for 10 minutes.